After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Sharon Salzberg Meta Hour. This podcast is a reflection of our connected lives and is dependent on the generosity of you, our listener. So please go to mindpodnetwork.com/Sharon and either use the donate button or bookmark the Amazon portal through which we will receive a percentage of whatever you purchase from Amazon, or sign up for a free trial with audible.com. We thank you for your support in allowing Sharon to continue to share her exquisite heart wisdom.
Hi everyone, this is Sharon, and I'm so happy to have Noah and Raghu here in my New York City sublet so we can talk about all kinds of things.
Yeah, you don't even know what.
I don't know what we're going to talk about. Yeah. That's the truth.
I have something in mind, but I'd like Noah to get a head start with you.
Okay. Well, I mentioned this right when I came over, but I sometimes like to think of myself as someone who doesn't get very upset or is reactive to things, and that's just not true. And usually that's confined to kind of my close relationships. I know you wrote the book Real Happiness at Work, and I've read the book and it's great and I apply it to all my situations, but I rarely have those friction situations because I work with a lot of great people. But I had a situation pop up last night that's really eaten into the better part of my day, where I got an email and it was unnecessarily rude objectively, and I just haven't been able to let it go. And, you know, it's easy for me because I'm freelance, like I'm just going to sever my ties with the client, however that shapes up, it's fine. But it's still like it's stuck with me now for almost 24 hours later. So, and in the moment, I try to breathe, I try to take the pause, but it just like, it's almost like I latch on to the anger, and it's just like a self thing. And it doesn't happen to me that often that what it does, it's like difficult for me to get out of it. So any tips or guidance with that is greatly appreciated.
Well, sometimes, it's great that you have so many options in life, actually, in terms of action.
Yeah.
Yes. Not everybody feels that, you know, in different situations, but that's tremendous that you've got that.
Yeah.
And I think given that, especially, I don't know that I would say the same thing, would say a different thing if you had a different situation, but I would actually try doing some loving kindness for the guy. You know, you were afraid I was going to say that, weren't you?
My mom said that.
Yeah.
And I almost got mad at her for that. And I was like, no, I'm not going to get mad at someone else. Like I was, and usually I'm really good at that. I'm really into, you know, the bhakti stuff too. So there's a lot of love and I try to cultivate that. But in this situation, I just couldn't get past what was going on at the time. Like I was making little cracks and I found that was helpful. But it still like was in the situation. And again, I'm lucky. I get to go through this outside of an office setting. So I'm not like, I couldn't imagine working in an office feeling how I was feeling. And I know a lot of people do have to deal with that. Like my wife has to deal with it. Lots of people do. So yeah, I know the loving kindness. I know.
Oh, damn. You know, well, it's kind of like this. You don't do it to sort of try to make yourself like the person,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That would be a big mistake.
Yeah.
You really do it more to lift the burden within yourself so
yeah.
that you're either not obsessed or consumed or you know, these things happen and people can be really unskillful in what they say, but then we go over it and over it and over it and over it, and we can't let it go by. And, and especially in your situation where you do have that freedom.
I know. And I was trying to, that ultimately when I could move on for various aspects of my days was the saving grace, is that I could just compartmentalize it, kind of move on to something else. It wasn't something I had to deal with immediately. And then I found just on the ride over here that it was popping up again. I'm like, I can't believe this. Like, it's, I don't even, it's not even that big of a deal. I know in like 3 or 4 days I'm gonna be like, oh, and feel more foolish about being upset and thinking all of the horrible things in my head. I know that's the first step too. I've learned that just from your meditation practices in general, and specifically rather, that just cultivating the awareness that that's going on is a really important step. So I recognize it, but I was still frustrated that I wasn't able to immediately get over it. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, the loving kindness is kind of a way of getting over it.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, just because it's like you had to be on the receiving end of that energy for a few minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
This person lives within that energetic field, right? Maybe a whole lot of the time. You don't know what their, or maybe you do know, but often we don't know the history of how off they've become, or things like that. And there's some place in us where we really do wish them not to be struggling so much or suffering so much.
If for no other reason than despair.
And even if you do decide not to work with them anymore, you know, you have an option of how you communicate that.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's one thing I've learned from, again, from you specifically, is I eventually responded to an email that I got very late in the night, and I wanted to fire back, like, a lot. Just really, it was bordering on unprofessional. I really am over that line, but it was still just, like, the intention behind it wasn't there. And over the course of half an hour, I got out a professional and respectful and, you know, dealing with it and just internalizing everything on my side. But and that was very useful too. That, I mean, without that, it could have just been a much worse situation. So I was grateful for that too. I mean,
so was anger part of your reactivity?
Yeah. Oh, I was super, I mean, that's what it was. I was incredibly angry. And like I said, I know where my trigger points typically for anger, and it's usually in relationships, close relationships, family, friends, you know, you're close and comfortable with people, but rarely in a professional setting do I get angry. I might get frustrated, but this was just like a pointedly kind of outside of a professional thing, and I was just like, I got very angry,
I find, since anger has always been part of my issue, I find that when I do get triggered, I can actually witness it after the initial bang.
Yeah.
But I mean milliseconds, that I am putting every other frustration and every other piece of anger and my whole past and just taking it and using it as a vehicle to abuse my own self.
Yeah.
And that we tend to do that. So
It was amazing because I noticed that it was so, I am not a very self-abusive person. But after my outburst last night and continuing today, I would find thoughts of like getting mad at myself, like really quickly and like easily for stuff like just aren't, they don't go through my head on a day-to-day basis. So I was like, I knew there was a connection there. And it was just remarkable how like those thoughts would just immediately permeate kind of like my regular state of being. So I know it's unproductive, which is why I want to cultivate all of the tools and things I can to prevent those things or dealing with them in a better way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe talk about the antidotes to anger itself as a singular, very powerful emotion that I think 99.9% of us really have to deal with at one point or another in our lives.
Well, we do have to deal with it, I think, at one point or another. There's also an interesting psychological map in Buddhist psychology of personality types, where the words sound a little nasty, but they're not really like nasty states. They're just talking about, while we all have a certain amount of grasping or greed in our being, a certain amount of anger, a certain amount of delusion, it also is the case that sometimes someone's personality is almost like constellated around one particular one of those. So it's not exactly like all three in equal measure. And that the personality type stuff is actually kind of fun. It's like if you're a greedy or grasping type, it doesn't mean you're a greedy person at all. Mm. I mean, you might be a phenomenally generous person. Mm. But it's sort of it's a tendency. It's like they say that if you have that as your personality type, then you would likely walk into a room and notice what you like. Mm. You notice what's pleasing to you. You don't want to look at what's displeasing.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the flaw in it. Is that you don't want to take in the whole picture. And yeah. So I describe that sometimes as the kind of person who, if you're sitting in a meeting with them and some problem is brought up, they'll say, "It'll all work out." And you think, "How? How's it going to work out?" You know, like Joseph Goldstein, who's far from a greedy person at all. He's a classic greedy type. Hmm. In that he likes to look at what's pleasant and,
oh, wow.
You know, that's why his...
That's,
you know, his architectural sense, like, is extraordinary, and his sense of harmony. And yeah. But he'll say, like, the example, I mean, he knows I tell the story, is like, once, oh, you know, Joseph is 6'3 and a half, and virtually all his frequent flyer miles are on United Airlines. And so he likes to use them to upgrade because it's so uncomfortable for him in coach. And so one day, years ago, I said to him, "Joseph, what will you do if United Airlines goes bankrupt before you can use all your frequent flyer miles?" He said, "It's not going to happen." And it was like a long time later, I thought, well, how do you know that? You know, like, so again, it's not at all that you're a greedy person. It's just a predisposition in a certain way. And all of these states have a purified side. You know, the purified side is attained through mindfulness. Like, so that... tendency toward looking at what's beautiful, looking at what's right, looking at what's pleasing to you.
That's called a greedy thing.
It's so interesting.
It's just like a greedy type.
Yeah, yeah.
In that personality typology or grasping
type. Is it because you're not encompassing everything?
Yeah.
So it's
you're
selectively like, oh,
that's
all the good stuff. I get it.
That's the greed.
I get it. But the purified form of that, like, they actually call faith, which doesn't mean faith, even in like a bhakti sense necessarily, or it certainly doesn't mean belief system. It means like a love of life, you know, because you get close to things. You're open to things, you know. And then the aversive type or the angry type is like the opposite. They're the kind of person who'll walk into a room and they'll overlook what's beautiful. And they'll just notice, look at that, the carpet's crooked, you know, like, couldn't she have straightened it up before these guests came over? You know, two carpets are crooked, look at that, right? And again, it's not like you're an angry person all the time or anything like that. It's just that's where you go, what's displeasing and to you. And I sometimes describe that as the kind of person who'll walk in, you know, be in a meeting and somebody will present this opportunity and their first thing is, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And then you think, well, why not? Yeah. You know, let's figure out how it's going to work. And that, too, has a purified side because the positive attribute in the anger or the aversion is like kind of cutting through. It's considered a kind of penetrating intelligence. It's like maybe nobody else wants to talk about that carpet being crooked, and it's actually important to bring up, but that person will do it. Mm. So there's like almost a kind of truth-telling sometimes that can manifest without the, you know, rigidity or without the burning. And then the deluded type, of which I strongly am. And again, not everyone is a type because you can have a sort
combo.
Of mix. Yeah, you can have a combo, but I'm powerfully a deluded type is described as someone who will walk into a room and not really notice anything until someone points it out to them. And they'll think, oh, right, I have a carpet. Look at that. I forgot. It's crooked, isn't it? Look at that. You know, and so... there's almost a kind of peacefulness sometimes in, for that type because you're spaced out. But the detriment, of course, is that you're very dependent on other people describing reality to you because you're not really paying careful attention yourself. And then you're so dependent that you're kind of vulnerable in that way. And so, and that too is transform through the practice of mindfulness so that you can have that kind of balance and evenness, but actually noticing, you know, rather than being lost in some other world. Yeah, and so there may be people who are just, for whatever reason, you know, the constellation of their energy is going to be toward aversion. It's, you know, dislike or fear, which is part of that same complex of aversion, anger, impatience, pushing away. But all is not lost, you know, because there is that jewel in there, that ability to cut through. And so we do practice mindfulness of the state itself so that we understand it better and we can transform the energy of it. And then, of course, the antidote to aversion, both anger and fear, is loving kindness.
Yeah.
Is actively practicing that that recognition of connection.
Mm. Is there, what are some of the other personalities?
No, those are the big three.
Those are the big three.
Yeah, and then the purified form. So they're kind of six.
Oh. Is this a Theravada?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the Mahayana, it's much more intricate, I think, with the Buddha families and stuff like that, which I don't really know that system.
Right. What's been on my mind is something actually we were, as you know, of course I do this work with Ram Dass, and we did a workshop with Ram Dass, Roshi Joan Halifax, and Frank Ossoseski, who's been involved in Death and Dying.
Mm-hmm.
You know who he is. It was really lovely. It was at Ram Dass's house and so on. And in the process, and it was all related to facing mortality as well as what the blessing is, that we can actually have an opportunity to transform ourselves. At one point, Ram Dass said, he just kept saying over and over, trust, trust, trust. That is what allows us to be, he didn't put it in these words exactly, friends with our mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved it because it wasn't about, faith is a difficult word.
Mm-hmm.
Now you wrote a whole book about faith, so
mm-hmm.
you well know some of the feedback you got before you wrote the book. What are you doing? But trust, and you know, and these words, faith and devotion and love and all, I mean, you once gave a great talk about love and how it means weakness to most people, you know, so true. Trust, though, it seems to me, on multiple levels, there's a way that you can access. Can you talk about trust and what it means to you?
I think that's a beautiful statement by Ram Dass, because there is a part, I see it in myself, you know, I think there's a part of our conditioning that says things should not be this way. I mean, it is ridiculous, isn't it? You know, like that we have to die or that time goes on. The example I've been using, which would make more sense to you than to Noah, is like I was doing my taxes recently and there were certain states in which I was trying to, I had like a tiny little bit of money and I was trying to use their online web thing, you know, to pay, and which never worked in any state. But anyway, you know, and then I had to put in my year of birth and I had to scroll down for like 15 minutes, it felt like, to get to 1952, you know, and I thought, it's ridiculous. Why are they starting with 10-year-olds? You know, it's like, you know, and they're not paying taxes. But the truth is that, you know, I'm not 18 anymore. And how did that happen? It's just like the most bizarre system.
Hmm.
So I think it's also natural to have this feeling of protestation. This makes no sense that we should have to depart this earth or lose everyone we love or, you know, carry that grudge forever and then have them die, you know, or whatever it is. It makes no sense. And so I think there is a place in which we withhold that kind of trust, and reasonably so. But then there comes a certain point where you just realize things are as they are. And sort of either living in denial or protestation or kind of insisting they be different than they are, it makes no sense either.
Yeah.
And that there's so much suffering there that the only way to peace and happiness is to relinquish that and come into harmony with how things are. Like Bob Thurman, as a scholar of Buddhism, and especially Tibetan Buddhism, often talks about, it's not a very glamorous word, but he often talks about things being realistic. And that's the goal, is to see what's realistic, what's real. And death is real, loss is real, change is real, time is real. In that sense, it's real, the passing of time. And we need to kind of relax a little bit and just say, yeah, this is how things are. So I really like that. I think trust is a problematic word. I think every word is probably problematic. You know, we live in a pretty cynical age, and people would say, why should I trust?
You
know?
I want to trust you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why should I trust this or you or it or whatever?
But, you know, some of this, I guess I was talking to some people, maybe it was a podcast, I don't even remember. But we were talking about that spark when we were young, and you know, a little old. Well, you're old now. Look, you're over 30.
Yeah,
how old are you?
I'm going to be 32 in July.
Oh my God.
The Buddha didn't get enlightened until he was 35.
There you go.
Yeah,
it's
a little bit of time.
Great.
So there was everyone had a spark,
mm-hmm.
that something dawned on us, that there was a chance, an opportunity, there was a possibility even that we could be happy in its most simplistic sense, that our senses, our egos weren't all that there is. So we all had that. And I think trust comes in as a good word then.
Mm.
It's like trusting you had that experience. Now, it could be through a psychedelic, which, by the way, we haven't talked too much about psychedelics, but they've been so powerful transformationally for us at that time,
mm-hmm.
And particularly for me, because it gave me some kind of reality, talking about reality, meeting a being like Neem Karoli Baba,
mm-hmm.
Through these experiences that have. But more strongly and to the point was, and this is something you can have for the rest of your life, and that's what I'm really talking about here, that you can reset. You talk about reset a lot, and I'd like you to talk more about it, because I think that's super, super important on a day-to-day basis when you're talking about,
yeah.
Noah, the stuff that you just went through.
Yeah.
There has to be a way to sort of reset that or start anew, whatever you want to call it. But to me, the leverage to do that, and that's what I heard from Ram Dass in that moment, was trust. And that means trusting in your experience. And it may be as simple as a loving kindness towards something that's manifest by itself. It's not something you purposefully do.
Mm-hmm.
And you have that feeling in the moment. Is that not a way for us to... is that really not a... I think it's a reset button of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of trust, which borders on faith, obviously.
Well, do you see a path to that trust? Like, how do you develop it? Or is it just...
Well, that's what
there?
You're here for. Give us the path to develop that trust.
Well, no. Maybe we have to ask Noah.
I mean... In terms of, I also had the psychedelic intro to some, just recognizing that there was a reality outside of kind of what you experience in waking or regular consciousness, and excluding dreams, because I don't think people typically think of dreams as that real, or a lot of people don't.
Yeah,
it's just some other place where things get worked out.
Mm.
And depending on what methodology or, you know, arena you come from, you have different views on it. So I had it there too, but I will say that most of the things that kind of confirmed my trust or kind of faith or confidence in just knowing that things are, this is the way they're supposed to be, didn't come until I stopped doing psychedelics, you know, regularly at least. I do very infrequently now, And that those points in between were actually the stronger kind of footholds that kind of gave me a basis. Because one of the things that I've experienced with psychedelics, and I know other people have had in varying degrees, is you don't know if that's like, that could just be a different thing. You know, that could be an aberration that's not a real place. And some people treat it as such. I never had that experience, but I did have things outside of that, just connecting dots, weird synchronicities, things that you don't have to ever do a psychedelic to experience. And those types of things with the meditative practice, the mindfulness stuff is so important. I think I was doing some form of mindfulness before I even meditated, sat down to do it, because there were a level of things where you would notice things, like this noting practice. Like, I would do that, but not in like a structured way. But when things would come up, be like, and I think everyone does that too. And that's why when you cultivate kind of that aspect, it really feeds into other aspects of your life, like over the long term and immediately if you pay attention, I think. So
I think this crosses over, though. I mean, when we talk about trusting whatever experience you might have, really into faith, and you did have that book. Talk about that.
Yeah, I was just thinking the subtitle of that book is Trusting Your Own Deepest Experience.
Really?
It's called Faith, that. Trusting Your Own Deepest Experience. And,
exactly.
I got a review in a newspaper, and the pretty much the entire review was about how they didn't like the subtitle. But anyway,
really?
Apart from that memory. I think there is a way we learn to trust our own sense of what is true. We can distinguish that from the voices clamoring inside our head of greed, hatred, and delusion, and you know, all the fears and stuff like that, and have a sense of clarity around things we've seen, things we sense, and they can be not very popular in the culture at large, but you know, things like holding on causes a lot of suffering. The only way to be free in this particular situation is to let go. That doesn't make me a fool or a weakling. You know, that's really the path to freedom. Where the very famous and kind of difficult comment by the Buddha, hatred will never cease by hatred. Hatred will only cease by love. This is an eternal law. Like, no one wants to think that, really, you know, but it's probably true. And if we look at our own experience with honesty and kind of rigor, you know, then we see, yeah, you know, that is true, that I just poured fuel on that fire and that it didn't help, and that this person I thought of as an enemy, I learned so much more about them years later, and I realized, oh, you know, of course they were all screwed up. Or as the Dalai Lama says, quoting Shantideva, this great Tibetan sage, enemies become friends, friends become enemies. You know, we get so rigid, we classify people in these different categories, and it's pretty variable, actually. Now, there's so many things that happen in life, and we kind of know a deeper truth very often, but we don't necessarily trust our knowing. And we think, oh, that can't be right. You know, every bit of mainstream media tells me the opposite, or that's the way I'll be happy, is the way they say I'll be happy, not the way I'm sensing I could actually be happier. Generosity is for suckers, or whatever it is, you know.
Well, cultivating, then now we're at cultivating. How do we cultivate that trust, that faith in what is, what we experience and know deep down inside?
I think for most of it, it's actually the willingness to make the experiment. You know, it's like you have to be able to, say, practice generosity as an experiment the whole time, keeping an eye on what your internal experience is. Not just do it because you're obliged to do it or something like that, but that's how we actually know where happiness comes from, not from what anybody says or preaches at us or whatever. It's from stepping out of what may be just ordinary or familiar, but keeping an eye on our heart space, you know, and actually knowing. Like, we have this practice we sometimes do, like, as an experiment up at and Barry around the Insight Meditation Society and the community of people that have been formed around there, where we say, okay, here's something you can undertake as a practice. It's like for the next little while, whatever the time period is, when a strong thought to give something arises in your mind, and it's reasonable, it's not like giving away the farm or something, you know, but a strong, and it's not just a little whippy passing thing, but a strong thought to give something arises in your mind and it's reasonable, give it. Mm-hmm. And keep an eye on your emotions and reactions and the whole thing. Like, give it, even if the next 50 thoughts are fearful. Like, oh no, you know, maybe I'll read it next year, or it's been in that pile for 3 years now, but I do need to read it, or, you know, what if I end up with nothing? You know, just like, give it. It's like you watch all the fear and what that feels like, and the withholding and the hesitation, and you watch what happens when you actually yield or relinquish that object. And that's how you know, is because you've seen for yourself.
Where does the watching happen from? I think that's important for you to single out. Because there's people can be self-consciously small witness, we would call it, in the,
mm-hmm.
in the Hindu tradition. Like, or, I don't mm-hmm. know mm-hmm. if it's Hindu. Ram Dass used to talk about it, wherever he got it. But, I mean, the idea of the witness, which is common throughout many
Yeah, well, that kind of witnessing, you know, we would call mindfulness. It's
yeah.
it's like the cultivation of an awareness that's not judgmental. And self-consciousness, which people often ask about, like, is am I going to feel stupid and self-conscious? Like, now I'm lifting my arm, you know, now I'm, like, opening my mouth or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not like that, because you're not forming judgments all the time. And if there are judgments arising, you're not buying into them. It's a pretty pure seeing of, okay, this is happening, and that's happening, and that's happening.
But isn't it true to get to that place in a way that you aren't going to get sucked in by either reactions or
mm-hmm.
self-identifications and so on, is through an ability to get your mind to one point? Is that not the basis before, to some degree?
There are some schools within Buddhism that would say absolutely that's true. And then there are other schools who would say, that one pointedness or that stability of attention can happen in a moment. So from that point of view, and it is just one point of view, you don't practice that kind of stabilization first.
Yeah.
You practice it all along the way. And that's very much how, say, Menindra would teach, or that Mahasi Sayadaw school, because their whole emphasis, or my teacher, Sayadaw Upandita, their emphasis is on continuity of awareness. So they say you get the same kind of stability that you're describing, or one-pointedness, through more moments of mindfulness in a row.
Mm.
Whether you're sitting, or you're standing up from the sitting, or you're folding your shawl after the sitting, or you're walking to where you can do walking meditation, or you're walking. It's all part of that effort toward being more continuous.
So completely at one with each motion.
And you're going to lose it. No doubt, a billion times, but that's where starting over comes back.
So you like string it together, the moments.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that just happened to be a historical controversy you touched upon inadvertently.
It's like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, right? In many of these talks, well, there's the Mandiyaka school.
That's right.
And then,
and
then they go into a whole thing about each school. By that time, about 3/4 of the people are sleeping in the hall.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's true. But I think the key is actually the other thing, which is starting over.
Starting over.
Realizing your mind's going to wander, you're going to blow it, you're going to fall asleep, you're going to get distracted, all kinds of things are going to happen, just like they all happen in life. And then you just let go and you start over and you start over and you start over. And that's really the most important thing.
You can trust in the starting over.
Yeah, you can trust in the starting over.
That's,
well, you need to.
You need to.
Yeah, and even if you don't trust it, you have to do it. You know, because it's the way it
right.
all works.
Yeah, it is. It just is.
Well, and I also think a component of it is, even with the gratitude, when you're saying when you have the impulse to give, for me at least, when I act on those impulses, and I've gotten better and better at it as years have gone on, you notice other things too that are external to you that start to happen. And that there's a component of trust that I think is interwoven with that. Not just kind of internally how you feel, which is obviously very, very important, but I am a strong believer in the more you give, the more you get. And you can do that from a selfish conception of I'm going to give a lot so I get a lot, but it just seems to be something that's the way it works. And that also kind of, that's what I was talking about, those moments in between, those types of things can really, you know, reinforce what you're doing. Yeah. So I've noticed that too. Yeah.
I just have to say something that we have at MindPod Network, and you probably haven't even heard about this, an incredible new line of t-shirts.
And apparel,
like from hoodies.
You have caps.
We don't have caps.
We have iPhone cases, hoodies.
What size iPhone?
I think
cases?
The new, the sixes. Oh. I believe.
No.
Are there
I
all
saw
them?
Them. They look like they're all there.
Oh.
Yeah. The four, the five.
How do I
six.
Find this stuff?
Well, we're going to get you one.
Tell
us exactly. But one of the t-shirts, because we're trying to represent all of the folks on MindPod, and one of the t-shirts is Love Your Enemies.
Oh.
Yes.
Wow.
So
it's been selling too.
You need to
it's
get that
selling?
T-shirt.
Yeah.
And this
oh,
is for you.
I know.
You
trust
get that
me.
T-shirt.
I want to go back to those iPhone cases.
Yeah,
I need one.
Yeah. There's...
Okay, you got it.
And do you have little tote bags?
Oh, no, we're not got that far.
We're not that far.
Do you have
You have a lot of desires.
I do have a lot of desires. Wait, but I have another question. Do you have like a tagline? Or something like that. You don't have to.
Yes.
You can edit this out too.
We do have a tagline.
We don't edit anything.
Really? No. What's your tagline?
Ancient wisdom for modern times.
That's nice.
Simple. It's not the most creative possibility, perhaps.
But it is.
But it does say it, right? Because.
And so I would recommend a tote bag with that
ancient,
tag.
Yes.
With that tag.
Tote bag is a great idea too.
Okay.
I just happen to have been carrying a tote bag from another organization with their tagline on it. And somebody I was meeting for breakfast said, "What's that bag?" And so it was a whole opening for her about the organization. So here's
well,
my
you
suggestion.
Know, this whole thing and this whole T-shirt thing that we're offering, it came from somebody coming to us and saying, "Hey, you should do this, and I'm going to help you do it." And they went and designed the whole thing, and put it, did everything.
Yeah, it was remarkable.
It was just so we have a wonderful community here.
That's fabulous.
And somebody in the community is going to go, "Hey, we're going to get a tote bag for you."
And the other thing I'll suggest is a yoga mat with your tagline.
That would be cool.
On it. Just saying.
Yeah.
I like all of these ideas.
Very good. But anyhow, everybody, I'm acting as the announcer for MindPod Network right now and saying this is a great way to support what Sharon's doing and what the network's doing. So go to mindpodnetwork.com and you can get yourself a t-shirt, or you can buy your stuff through Amazon, or you can just plain old make a donate.
MindPodNetwork.com.
Mm-hmm.
No, when I got a new iPhone, I lost my case, so it was very.
Okay, see,
it's very
this
important
has worked
question.
Out very well for
yeah.
you. Well, thanks for letting us be on your
thank you
show.
Yeah.
Sure, then you can say on my couch. Totally fine. It's great. It's great to see you both.
Great to see you. We love you, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Sharon Salzberg Meta Hour. We really do appreciate your support and hope you will continue that support by going to mindpodnetwork.com/Sharon and clicking on the donate button, or by using our Amazon.com portal for all of your purchases. Namaste.